Hello, I'm Ivan Berg, and this is my story. Part 5, September 1953 to February 1954. On my last trip on the Cape Town Castle, I made friends with a couple of passengers who owned a small hotel in Durban called the Norfolk Hotel, close by one of the city's popular beaches. The ship's turnaround took 3 days, and as there were no passengers, I had a good amount of time off. The Goldbergs adopted me. I was driven around Durban, taken to a game reserve and a Zulu dance display. I posed for a photograph in a rickshaw pulled by a giant Zulu wearing an enormous headdress, and was shocked by the colour bar, which the Goldbergs took for granted. Apartheid was yet to become law, but nevertheless a colour bar was in place everywhere. Even the wooden benches overlooking the beach displayed a whites only notice. Back in Cape Town, a drama awaited I was shot at. I went ashore with two other saloon boys on a very hot afternoon and went into a bar near the docks for an ice-cold Coca-Cola. We sat at a table in a cool corner, sipping our drinks, when suddenly the swing doors banged open and a huge South African Boer charged in, waving a revolver. He looked very drunk. He also looked very angry. He started shouting in Afrikaans and then pointed the gun at us. He was blocking the door, so we couldn't make a dash for it, so we dived under the table as he began firing. He loosed off 3 shots before the doors banged open again and 2 policemen charged in, knocking him down in the process. 3 very relieved and shaken saloon boys made their way back to the ship. I signed off the Cape Town Castle on November the 6th, 1953, and like many other catering boy ratings in the Merchant Navy at the time, decided to have a go at getting a job on one of the Queens, the transatlantic superliners Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth, the greyhounds of the North Atlantic, the Mary and the Lizzie. That's where the money was, that's where the glamour was. Film stars were regular travellers, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, Diana Dawes, Frank Sinatra, Ava Gardner, the list goes on. Southampton to New York in 5 days, New York to Southampton in 5 days, regular as clockwork. One day turnaround in New York and 2 days turnaround in Southampton. One trip off every 5 trips. Make lots of money in tips, eat great food, buy clothes in New York and become a Cunard Yank. A Brooks Brothers suit, button-down collar, matching tie pin and cufflinks, and a pack of Chesterfield cigarettes in your shirt pocket, and a one-handed flip-up Zippo lighter in your jacket. But it was not to be. The Cunard Catering Staff Office was in a small building in front of Southampton's new ocean terminal. The Queen Mary was berthed alongside, and it was huge. It was the second biggest liner in the world. Only its sister ship, the Queen Elizabeth, was bigger, but not by very much. I try to remember the cutaway illustrations of the 2 ships I wondered at as a schoolboy. But the reality was overwhelming. I joined a queue of maybe 40 or 50 Cunard hopefuls. It looked like I was the only boy rating, and I wondered why. I found out about an hour later when it was my turn to present my seaman's book. The ship's writer behind the desk took one look at it and told me to try again when I had my rating. And that was 4 months away. And anyway, getting a job on one of the Queens was not a level playing field for would-be Cunard Yanks, as I was to discover when I eventually made my way from plate man to kosher pantry man to assistant writer in the writer's office, of which more later. So I had to find a job on a ship from now, that is the middle of November, until I was 18 and get my rating after my birthday at the end of March. I also wanted a bit of time off to see René Britton and Sam Kiff, as well as my parents and young brother. I wouldn't see Nick Britton as he was on the New Zealand run on the motor ship Rangitata. In fact, I didn't see him again until he was forced to stay ashore for good due to his ignominious and sudden expulsion from the Merchant Navy. So I stayed ashore until just after Christmas when I joined the good ship RMS Andes, Royal Mail steamer, on the Southampton to Buenos Aires run. I got a job as lift boy, not by going to the Shipping Federation office, I had good reason for staying clear, as you will recall, but by hopping on a bus to Leadenhall Street and walking into the Royal Mail office. That trick worked again, and after a phone call or two, I was given a slip to take to the Southampton office, where I would be sorted out. I remember spending a lot of time at the Crow's Nest and in the pub on the corner. I discussed science fiction and the technology of the future with Sam over beer and cigarettes, and books and writers and other worldly stuff, at least for me, over coffee with René. The beginning of my education proper, you might say. My parents were very likely put out that I didn't spend more time with them those few weeks. But I was excited and stimulated by René and Sam. I did spend Christmas at home, not that it was celebrated. We did watch the Queen's speech on the new television, which, and Michael will bear with me on this, was mainly purchased for the televised Saturday afternoon horse racing, my father being an inveterate gambler with a telephone betting account. So I joined the Royal Mail steamer Andes on the South American mail run on the 7th of January 1954. The itinerary included Las Palmas, Rio de Janeiro, Montevideo and Buenos Aires. Instead of operating one of the ship's two lifts, one forward and one aft, that I had signed on for, I was told to report to the first class restaurant. I was to be the head waiter's commis, that is, his dedicated assistant. The head waiter was from Southampton, but pretended he was French. He was short, tubby, and sported a waxed handlebar moustache and wild eyebrows. When I reported to the restaurant, he looked me up and down, inspected my hands, and then waved at his trolley and told me to make sure it was prepared for dinner that evening. The headwaiter's speciality was crepe Suzette's, and his flambé trolley was prepared accordingly. I checked the mess level in the burner, added a few more oranges to the orange bowl, filled a sugar bowl, and checked the bottle of Grand Marnier liqueur. This only had about an inch of liqueur left, so I requested a new bottle from the bar, took the seal off and put it on the trolley. I then went off to sort out my locker, see the glory hole steward to make up my bunk, and then I went up on deck to watch the ship leave harbour, which I still found exciting. It was, after all, only my fourth trip. Dinner progressed well that evening. The captain's table had requested crepe Suzette's. At the appropriate time, I collected the crepes from the galley, some fresh butter, and 8 warm plates. The head waiter snapped his fingers at me, and I pushed the trolley towards the table. The mess burner was already burning a nice blue flame. Flambé at the table is a bit of show business, and this head waiter was a real show-off. Pan on the burner, butter sizzling in the pan, together with spoons of sugar. Then the oranges sliced in half, and juice teased out with a fork over the pan. Everything done with a well-practiced flourish. The crepes went into the pan and turned and soaked in the sugary, buttery, orangery liquid. The head waiter's arm reached out for the bottle of Grand Marnier, and with a final flourish, upended the bottle over the pan, expecting just the right amount of liqueur to flow out. Except, of course, the bottle was full. The upending of bottle flourish was so well practiced that once it began its arc, it couldn't be stopped. The head waiter's expression was a wonder to behold as it changed from show-off to astonishment to horror, all in the same instant. Well, you can guess what happened next. The pan overflowed, the burner flame ignited the highly inflammable liquid, a sheet of flame burst out of the pan and leapt upwards, singeing the head waiter's moustache and eyebrows on its way towards the sprinklers in the deckhead. The next morning, I reported for duty as lift boy on the after lift, the one towards the back of the ship that was rarely used. The head waiter had actually been surprisingly magnanimous about what became known among the crew as Berg's bomb. And fortunately, the flame did not set off the restaurant sprinklers. Very few passengers used the afterlift, so I spent a lot of time going up and down empty and then sitting on a chair on A deck just outside the lift, twiddling my thumbs. That is, until we stopped at Lisbon to pick up passengers travelling to Brazil. For some reason, a very well turned out and obviously very rich family decided to use my lift every mealtime to travel the one deck to the first class restaurant. Husband, wife, small son, and a very lovely daughter about my age, whose name, I think, because it was such a long time ago, was Esmeralda. Esmeralda quickly saw that I had lots of time on my hands and decided, with the permission of her father, to ask me to help her with her English. Because of my dark hair and, Esmeralda said, dark good look, Esmeralda's father was convinced by his darling daughter that I had some Brazilian blood and believed my story that I was not really a lowly lift boy, but at sea to gain experience for a career as a novelist, and thus agreed to leave the lovely Esmeralda alone with me. By the time the ship reached Las Palmas, I was in love. Her English improved rapidly. We spent a lot of time in the lift with the doors closed. But it was all very young and innocent. Kissing and cuddling went no further. Then, to my complete surprise, Esmeralda said she wanted to marry me. I could live in São Paulo and write my novels. She said I wouldn't have to worry about money, as her father was a very big man in the bank. If I agreed, I would have to be interviewed by her father, and if he agreed, well, then everything would be fine. And then another surprise. Esmeralda's father agreed, but said I would have to live in Brazil for a while before announcing the engagement, and of course to make sure that I really loved his daughter and that she really loved me. And then he asked me how old I was. And that was the beginning of the end. As I was not yet 18, the captain was my legal guardian and would have to give his consent. Esmeralda's father went to see the captain. The captain said he would have to cable my parents. He said, my parents said no. Esmeralda was in tears. I've totally forgotten my reaction. Nevertheless, when we reached Santos, I was given time off and was taken by a limousine to Esmeralda's family home in São Paulo for dinner. Of course, we said we would write to each other every day and that as soon as I was 18, I would be back and we could continue where we left off. It never happened. After a tearful goodbye at the end of the evening when the car came to take me back to the ship, I never heard another word. I wrote several letters but received no reply. I tried to telephone when the ship docked at Santos on the return trip, but couldn't master the Brazilian payphone system and gave up when my money ran out. So it couldn't have been the one great love of our lives, just one of those lightweight shipboard romances soon to be forgotten. But I still sometimes wonder whether Esmeralda or her parents had a hidden agenda and were looking for a quick solution to a pregnancy that never was, or what my life would have been if I had been 18, or if my parents had said yes. In Rio, I had time to visit Sugarloaf Mountain and Copacabana Beach. In Montevideo, I wondered at the beautiful squares of municipal buildings and thought the skyscrapers in the centre of town somehow out of place. The Andes turned around in Buenos Aires and stayed 4 days. This meant a reasonable amount of time off to go sightseeing. In Argentina, it was the time of the dictator Perón. Armed Peronista vigilantes roamed the streets of Buenos Aires, ostensibly keeping the peace. Crew members going ashore were told that the vigilantes often stopped people carrying shopping bags and parcels and confiscated anything that took their fancy. We were told not to protest. I was never stopped, but then I couldn't afford to buy anything that might be attractive enough to be confiscated. We were also told not to take a camera ashore, as these were banned. So, no photographs of my Buenos Aires adventures in the archive. The first time I ventured ashore, I nearly turned right round again. As I approached the dock gate, I saw it was guarded by 2 armed men. A sailor from another ship was walking a few yards in front of me. He strode through the gate without stopping, just glancing at the 2 guards. The guards shouted, "Parada!" The sailor looked round but continued walking. They shouted again in English, "Hey, you, stop, halt!" The sailor continued walking. What happened next was fast and hardly believable. One of the guards pulled out his pistol, aimed and fired, not into the air, as I expected, but at the sailor's back. I don't think the guard killed him, but he did fall down. I didn't move. I didn't dare. Then one of the guards beckoned me. I was terrified. I walked to the gate and stopped as he held up his hand. Then he looked me over and waved me through. I didn't wait to see what happened to the sailor. I was too scared. I didn't even look at him as I walked past. I really wanted to go back to the ship, but I thought that turning around and going back might make the guard suspicious, so I walked on. Of course, I didn't mention any of this in my letters home. I wrote excitedly that Buenos Aires really is a wonderful place. Everything is so orderly. It's based on the American system of blocks. A map of the city looks like a drafts board. It doesn't. I must have been looking at a simplified graphic. It's very nice during the day, I said, but you ought to see it at night. After midnight, it's colossal. Corrientes, one of the main avenues, Looks like pictures of Broadway you've seen. It's as light as day. And the clubs, the Cabana, Morocco, Cabilda, Conurbana, all with first-class bands, chairs and tables in the streets, so you can watch the life while you eat and drink. I couldn't afford to sample any of these, but it's great just to walk around. I've never seen a place like it. Lavaci is a main street with 52 cinemas along it, all showing different films. Can you imagine the neon lights? Sounds all a bit breathless. Well, I was an innocent of 17, and you have to remember that the UK in 1954 was, by comparison, a very grey and very drab place. When the ship returned to Santos on the return trip, and I found myself with little to do after having no success contacting Esmeralda, I went ashore with two other boy ratings. I've forgotten their names, but let's call them John and Mike. Mike waved an address he'd been given by one of the deckhands. A grinning taxi driver dropped the three of us off outside a large and really rather splendid villa. We went through the gate, up the steps to the double door, and Mike looked at John and me, grinned and winked, and rang the bell of the brothel.